want to tell us about is how to test for microscopic discretization.
Thanks, Ravi. Ravi has done something very meritorious here. He has managed to get me speaking about a paper that I put in archive in 2011. I published it 2 years later, and it has not a single citation, everything. So I think, I owe you a bow, right?
I'm going to cite this paper
if you like it. Okay, this is a distribution of IQ scores of the population, right? You have more than this, then you can enter Mensa, the high IQ society. And if you have more than this, then you can enter Densa. It's the society of average IQ. It's also probably funnier. Then this other graph I want to show you. It's a graph of the height of women and men in a large population. Well, you can say women tend to be shorter, but also they have less variability. So if you meet a midget, then most likely it's a man. And my favorite one is this one. Some people in the UK, they started measuring the speed of different cars passing through a road, and then they found that they follow this distribution. Well, the bottom line is that all these quantities are Gaussian, and there are many quantities in nature that which follow a Gaussian distribution. And if you go to statistics 101, they tell you the reason is the central limit theorem. And what does it say? So the multivariate version is like this. You have some vectors of variables, and then you add them up. And then you get you could imagine that these are microscopic variables, which are not accessible. And once you add them up, you get some vector of observable quantities that are, you could call them macroscopic. And the central limit theorem tells you that under some conditions of these variables here, then these things will follow a multivariate Gaussian distribution. So that's the explanation that normally you get in statistics 101 when you ask how come that everything is Gaussian. They tell you, well, what happens is that each of these variables is the sum of many independent contributions, and that's why you get an overall Gaussian distribution. Now, we used to the central limit theorem, which each of these vectors is distributed identically and independently. But actually, you don't really need these assumptions to get a central limit theorem. Actually, independence plus some really mild assumptions, it's enough to guarantee that you will get a multivariate Gaussian distribution. And so there's not even that. You can even tolerate a bit of dependence and still you get a Gaussian. But in any case, what the central limit theorem does is to make a sort of map between a microscopic distribution, a microscopic of variables that perhaps you cannot access, and it turns it into a macroscopic distribution. When you wonder what would happen if I had many copies of this distribution and I added in the map. Now, this project started because my collaborators and I were wondering what would happen if we could invert this map. Because normally I don't really have access to these microscopic things, right? I mean, when people tell you, the height of a population follows a Gaussian distribution because it's the sum of many individual components. What are they talking about? Which are these individual components? Do they refer to genes? What are these things, right? So the idea is like, okay, let's take the microscopic things which we can actually observe and they try to infer something about these microscopic variables which generated this distribution in the first place. Okay, so we decided to focus on situations where these microscopic distributions or these microscopic variables actually have a discrete amount of levels. And so the kind of questions I'm going to try to answer is the following. I start with a discrete microscopic model. I impose some restriction on the spectrum of these variables. And then I get some restriction on the macroscopic variables that I will observe. Why? The main motivation was fundamental physics. Because there are so many quantities that nowadays we measure and then we find them to be continuous, or we believe them to be continuous, but actually they could be discrete. And it would be cool if this discretization would leave a signature at the microscopic level. And that's why this talk is titled Testing Microscopic Discretization. Okay, let's put in an example. Suppose that I take a laser, I pass it through a nonlinear optical element, and then I divide it with a beam splitter. Then I will get two beams of light. And I could send one of them to some experimentalist, Alice, and another one to another, Bob. And what happens here is that if I ask Alice and Bob to conduct homodyne measurements, they will obtain two continuous variables, X and Y, which will follow some Gaussian distribution. Now, Alice and Bob could make themselves the same question. Why is this thing Gaussian? I mean, it could be any other distribution. Why should it be Gaussian? And they could conclude, well, okay, following the same logic that teachers in statistics 101 follow. It could be that this thing is Gaussian because it's the sum of many independent things. So that's why they could come up with this explanation for what they are observing. They could, I call it the microscopy dichotomic model. And in this explanation, this model for this experiment, these people assume that whenever they initialize their experiment, there's some event that produces many independent particle pairs. I will assume that each of the particle in its pair, the two particles in the pair are identical, but they could be different if you move along different pairs. For example, these two could be electrons and these two could be muons, for example. Now, these beams of particles reach Alice's lab, and then they interact with the detector. And how do they interact? Well, I call it dichotomic model because I'm assuming that this detector can only resolve two different states of these particles. So I assume that these particles have some label. You can call it state, but it can be something else, right? And depending on this label, then this detector will emit, when they impinge upon it, it will emit some amount of electrons, or it will produce some current, some electrical current. And if they're in state two, they will produce some other electrical current. But I'm not going to make an assumption about what the values of these two things are. I just assume that there are two. You can even complicate it a bit more, because it will be more realistic to say that if the particle is in state one, then it will produce the detector will produce some current distributed according to some distribution rho one. And if it's in state two, it will follow some other distribution. But, it's still part of this dichotomic model. So this is the microscopic dichotomic model. And I'm assuming that I don't know what these things are. They can have some particles. They can be different species of particles. Each of them can have a different probability distribution for these two states. And what I observe is just simply the sum of all these intensities of electricity that these things are creating in the detectors. Okay, so these people are observing a Gaussian distribution. A Gaussian distribution is determined by this Feynman vector, which is simply the average value of these quantities, and also the covariance matrix, which is a bit more complicated. Now, if I let someone normalize the variables, they can make sure that the covariance matrix satisfies trace equal to 1. And in that case, if you project the set of possible covariance matrices over these two components, you'll find that the set of all possible Gaussians live within this circle. Okay, so now we go to the microscopic dichotomic model. We're assuming that these are not generic Gaussians, right? I mean, these are Gaussians which are generated by a number of particles, different species of particles, producing completely different responses of the detectors, and with some distributions that are completely arbitrary. And it turns out that even though I'm giving you really a lot of possibilities, really the most complicated setup or scenario where you can have this dichotomic model, right, where you can have only two levels, you cannot really fill the whole thing. You can only fill this square. So you conduct some experiment with Gaussian states of light, and you find a point here, then you would have disproven that Gaussian states of light are generated by pairs of dichotomic particles. Now, in this case, it's easy to see why you get this restriction, so I'm going to show the proof. Let's try to prove this inequality. This inequality is simply that gamma xx minus gamma xy is equal to, exactly equal to 0. Okay, so each of these distributions, each of these particles will have a distribution of states, where this a and b can take only two values, because we allow these things to have two states. And then you can verify that the contribution of each of these elements of the covariance matrix will be proportional to these expressions, right? To some term depending on the probability that Alice's particle is in state one, and some other term that depends on the probability that both of them are in state one or only Bob's particle, etc. Now, if I want to prove this, it's enough that I can prove it for each possible species, for each I. Okay, so if you substitute the definition, you can go from here to here. If you substitute this probability, the probability that Alice's particle is in state one, by the probability that both particles are in state one. And then if you substitute, you get this expression, which is obviously greater than or equal to 0. This is how you derive this kind of inequalities. Now, let's apply these things to something, right? I mean, completely different, Brownian motion. You have a particle that is moving in an apparently unpredictable way, and you want to study it in the lab. So what you do is, at time zero, you record the position of the particle, and then you study how it displaces after some amount of time, capital T. And then you find that, suppose that you find that this probability distribution of these two variables is also a Gaussian distribution with some covariance matrix. Now, how can you try to explain this? You can follow the examples of the path of Einstein. Einstein would say, okay, I'm trying to model this kind of behavior, assuming that at each point, or in some intervals of time, this particle is subject to some random forces or whatever, right? And then with some probability, it will go either up or down, and with some probability, it will go either left or right. And this will be the probability. It will be a minimal amount, and what I'm observing after some amount of time is just simply the sum of all these displacements, these random displacements. Okay, I could even, well, Einstein didn't thought that it was a sort of a stationary, but I'm going to assume that if this even depends on t, as long as it depends in a periodic way. And I'm going to assume that also this distribution does not depend on what the particle did before in order to get independence. Well, it turns out that if you study the set of all Gaussian distributions that you can generate with these kind of models, you find that they also belong to the microscopic dichotomic model. So you also satisfy these four inequalities. Now, you could demand something else, because it could be, from what I told, that I give you the description, the microscopic description of the movement of this particle, and you could find a microscopic dichotomic model if you take these two axes. But maybe if you take these other two orthonormal axes, you won't find it. So suppose that you want a scenario where you want, no matter which axis you take, you can always find a microscopic dichotomic model that makes sense of your observations. Then you would have to impose that no matter how you rotate this matrix, you still satisfy these constraints. And if you work out the algebra, what you find is this condition. So the conclusion is that if you want to apply this model by Einstein to two-dimensional random walks, then you can only do that when you have a distribution given by a covariance matrix satisfying this inequality. Okay, I'm going to try to generalize all these things. There are two ways of generalizing. The first is the easy way. It's what I call fixed output structure. Suppose I know something about these variables, this variable which is generating these macroscopic observables. So suppose I know the spectrum, but the spectrum of all the variables of each of the elements of the tuple, but I only know it up to a proportionality constant. The idea is like, I know that things are quantized, but I do not know the scale. So can I say something about, even though I don't have any knowledge of the scale, can I say still something about the macroscopic distribution? An example could be you could call the macroscopic spin model. So Alisamo have already refuted the microscopic dichotomic model, and then go to something more complicated, where you allow the levels of this particle to be, equally spaced, okay? You assume that this thing has d levels, and they're equally spaced.
So far, we can't see this.
Sorry. Oh, really? Yeah, it's true.
It's about to go.
I think I can use the white one. Okay, I have already. Okay, simply a spectrum like this. These levels are equally spaced, that's all, and you have these levels. The microscopic spin model. Okay, so let's start with the general case. We're not in the microscopic spin model, we're in any other model where I give you the spectrum, and I suppose that the statistics of or the possible values that these variables can take follow this spectrum modulo some scale factor that I don't know. Okay, well, I have a Gaussian distribution. This is my observable quantity, and this is given by some displacement vector, and also, which you can prove that in most cases doesn't give you any information, and also a covariance matrix. The covariance matrix gives you a lot of information. We will see it now. The problem is this nasty term here, which is nonlinear. Because there's a nonlinear term, what happens is that you cannot use linear programming to characterize these things directly. So you have to think a bit more. And at the beginning, we didn't know really what to do with that, but then we have this revelation, and we realize that, it's very difficult to characterize which is the set of all covariance matrices that arise when you have you really fix the structure that you have. But it is not difficult to characterize the cone. If you don't really know the scale, actually the problem becomes easier. And in this case, the cone is generated by a finite number of rays. So this implies that I can use linear programming to characterize the set of all matrices that are generated in these kind of models. And it also implies that for any microscopic model with a finite dimension, where this, the number of levels is finite, it can be distributed any way you like, but it's finite, then you can always find biparticles or distributions which would allow you to refute this model. And this follows from the fact that you can characterize all this set of covariant metrics using linear programming. Because with linear programming, you can only characterize polytopes. So what you're doing, is what each of these models is doing, is giving some inner approximation, inner polygonal approximation of this circle. So of course, with a finite number of vertices, you can only approximate that to some precision, right? And you can always find points in the circle which are not inside the polygon. So you can always falsify this kind of models. Okay, going back to this microscopic spin modeling, in this case you can find it's not difficult to prove this kind of inequalities.
How do you know it's an inner approximation?
Well, it has to be inner because it's a Gaussian distribution, so it has to belong to the set of all possible Gaussian distributions, so it cannot be outer. Okay, so in the microscopic spin model for any D, you always have this relation. This relation is useful because you can violate it. You can violate it in a quantum optics experiment, provided that you have enough energy. So for any body of D, you can always design some quantum optics experiment which would refute the microscopic spin model. Now, the thing is that about this inequality is that it becomes irrelevant when you take D to infinity. It just tells you that this quantity is smaller than infinity. Well, it's obvious, right? I mean, it's what you would expect. Because what happens is that when you take the number of levels really, really, really high, when you have really a spectrum in which all the variables are equally spaced and you have arbitrarily many levels, what you can imagine is to discretize the original distribution or the space where this original distribution lives. And of course, you can approximate any distribution provided that discretization is fine enough. And actually, this happens not only when you have levels which are at the same distance, but it happens whenever your levels or the spectrum is given by some rational non-constant function of A, and A goes through all the natural numbers. So this made us think, well, could it be that, it's just simply because we're thinking of variables which have an infinite spectrum, could it be that any system, in a microscopic system, that in which each of the variables can take infinitely many possible different values, could it be in each of these systems you can generate all possible Gaussian distributions? And the answer is no, not even in the bipartite case. Because what happens is that, take this one, right? I mean, this is a spectrum which is, you could call it the exponential spectrum. It depends on this value of mu. For mu equals 1 over 5, you can plot it, and you get these nice inequalities here. For mu equals 1 over 9, these inequalities get more and more pronounced, and then for mu tending to 0, you get again the microscopic dichotomic model. So it's not as simple as saying that you have finitely many models, finitely many variables or outcomes. Okay, so far I was assuming that I had some information, some prior information about what are the levels of these particles, right? I mean, I knew the spectrum somehow up to scale. But suppose I don't know even that. Suppose that the only promise I have is that each of these variables have D levels, and I don't know what these values, what are the values of these outcomes. Well, if I don't impose anything, then you can recover all Gaussian distributions with D equals 2. With 2 levels, you can recover everything that you can watch. But you can falsify the model if you complicate it a bit more. So suppose that I assume that the spectrum of these variables is completely unknown, but it is the same as the spectrum of this other variable, or the spectrum of this other variable. As you move within a given tuple, the spectrum is the same. And the spectrum could be different if you go to another tuple of variables, right? It could be different, but nonetheless, it's the same within the within the tuple. Now, why would you be interested in characterizing this? Well, this is what you have when you do time measurements. So you could imagine that this x1 is the sum of the contribution of all these microscopic variables at time t1. And x2 would be the sum of the same variables, but at time t2. And you would expect that at time t2, this variable may have changed the value, but you wouldn't expect that it has changed the spectrum in many situations. So this is still a good model. Okay, so you could call gdn to the set of all Gaussian distributions of n variables, which are generated by microscopic systems of dimension d. And what we prove is that in the paper is that if you choose d equals to n plus 1, you can recover all Gaussian distributions. But if you choose it a bit smaller, then you cannot. And this is an easy construction. And the difficult part, at least for us, was to prove this non-equivalence. We found a witness. We found out all distributions of n variables which are generated by microscopic variables of n values have to satisfy this non-trivial uncertainty relation, which in general is violated. Okay, so geometrically what this means is that if you consider the set of all possible Gaussian distributions and the, well, normalized Gaussian distributions or normalized covariance matrices, and the set of all possible normalized covariance matrices which are, well, this will be, okay, this is the set of all possible Gaussian distributions, and this is the set of all possible Gaussian distributions generated by variables which can only take d values. Then there's a separation, and this separation goes as the exponential of minus n. It's a really, really small difference. So in principle, you wouldn't, I mean, if I just saw this, I wouldn't be tempted to study this kind of things. Because, I mean, what do you care, right? I mean, it's really difficult to distinguish in practice. But it would be unfair, because there will be, as I don't know, putting Ruyo and Ken to fight in Street Fighter and say that they are more or less the same. Of course, they are more or less the same. You already knew it, right? I mean, n plus 1 is very close to n, as at least in, as a fraction, right, as n goes to infinity. But in order to make things fair, or to judge whether this makes any sense to study this kind of thing, you should consider the limit when n tends to infinity and compare the set of all possible Gaussian distributions of infinitely many variables or arbitrarily many variables with the set of all the Gaussian distributions which you can generate with variables which can only take d values. And in that case, you do find a separation, and the separation, it does go to zero with the dimension, but at least it does go as the inverse of a polynomial, which is something. Okay, the other thing that we found is that if you give me some distribution and then you ask me, well, can I generate it with this system of d-variables, of d-values, I can solve this question using a semi-infinite programming. And the reason is that, well, any matrix that meets a set of decomposition, you can express it like this, where this ZP are the variables of your problem. They are positive semi-infinite matrices. They cannot be arbitrary. And these P's, they are not arbitrary. They belong to a special set, a finite set. And so you have an idea what they look like. Here you have the set of all these p's when you have variables or three variables, which can take which arise out of microscopic distributions with three outcomes. And this allows you to make pictures, for example, like this one, right? This is a slice of the set of all trivariate Gaussian distributions. This is what you can generate with microscopic systems of dimension 2. This is microscopic systems of dimension 3 and microscopic systems of dimension 4. Okay, the problem of this method is that, you have some infinite program, but the number of these matrices grows exponentially with n, with the number of variables. So yes, it's a semi-infinite program, but the number of variables grows exponentially, so you can only hope to solve this problem in practice for a really, really system with a really small number of variables.
What is this SDP exactly?
Semi-infinite programming, it's like a branch of numerical analysis that is concerned with solving these kind of problems. Let me see if I remember. Mm-hmm. It's like this. You want to minimize this scalar product. These are your free variables. And this is a vector. This is the entry of the problem, the input of the problem. You want to minimize the scalar product subject to the constraint that some matrix F0 plus xi, these variables, multiplied by some other matrices, give you some overall matrix which is positive semi-definite. And these are kind of problems that we know how to solve very well. We have really, really good solvers to solve these problems, and also there's a really good theory to understand these solutions. So whenever you can reduce any problem to a semi-infinite problem, typically it means that you can solve it efficiently. In this case, it doesn't work because the number of free variables that we have here grows exponentially.
So is it a special case of linear programming?
It's an extension of linear programming.
Why is it an extension?
Because if this matrices,
no,
if you take these matrices to be diagonal, all these matrices to be diagonal, you have a linear program, uh-huh. And you can have all linear programs that way. So it includes linear programming.
The positive semi-definite's a non-linear constraint. If you could think of it in terms of determinants. So it's,
yes.
Well,
so
there's a constraint on x. It's x.
Huh?
Yes, that's a constraint.
Is there a constraint on x as mm-hmm. well?
Yeah,
has,
sure.
X
has to be such that this affine combination of matrices is positive semi-definite. This is a matrix that depends linearly on x.
This is a matrix inequality.
Yeah.
I see.
So intuitively, with linear programming, you can characterize polytopes, so things which are defined by a finite number of linear inequalities, right? And with semi-infinite programming, you can characterize things that also have like bumps. Yes, yes, you can characterize curved surfaces.
I see.
Okay. Well, in any case, there is a semi-infinite program to solve these problems, but it doesn't really work that well because the complexity scales really, really badly. And in the beginning, we thought that maybe this was because we're not clever enough to find a better method. But apparently not. Apparently, it's much deeper than this. Consider this problem. I give you some matrix. It's an n times n matrix. It has trace equal to 1. And the problem is to decide if this matrix is at a distance of the set of all matrices, that covariance matrices that you can generate with dichotomic variables. A distance is more than one of the inverse of a polynomial. You have to just say whether yes or no. This problem is NP-hard. So it is unlikely that you can find a simple method to solve these kind of problems. Okay, the reason is some reduction to some problem, but I'm not going to do that. Okay, now quantum. I'm going to, this is the only moment of the talk I'm going to speak about quantum systems. Think about a quantum experiment of non-locality. So you normally they are bipartite, so let's focus on just on bipartite experiments. You have an event that produces a pair of particles. It can be photons, can be electrons, whatever. One of them goes to Alice's lab, another one goes to Bob's lab. And then Bob Alice subjects her particle to some interaction S, and then the particle impinges on a detector, and you get an outcome. And the same with Bob. And what happens is that if you condition on these two interactions, S and T, you will get some distribution which doesn't admit a classical explanation. So what this means is that if you were to reanimate Sir Isaac Newton and you show him the experiment, he wouldn't know what to think. You need somebody like Dirac in order to come up with quantum theory or some other theory to make sense of this kind of experiments. Now, suppose that you repeat the same experiment, but now you bring it to the macroscopic scale. So now you don't have a small event that produces a pair of particles. You have a big event that produces lots of pairs of particles, independent pairs of particles. So now, as before, Alice can interact with all these particles, with this beam of particles, but she has to interact with all the particles on the beam in the same way, because she has the same apparatus as she had before. And she gets a reading, right? But the reading is the sum of all possible readings of all these particles impinging on the detector. And because of the central limit theorem, you can show that each of these distributions that you get will be a Gaussian distribution. Now, because of macroscopic locality, you can prove that all these Gaussian distributions, if they arise from a quantum system, they are local. They admit a classical explanation. So even though Newton was not able to make sense of the microscopic experiment, if you show him a macroscopic experiment, he could come up with a classical theory that gave exactly the same results. So he wouldn't be that surprised. Now, the problem is that the map that we found between quantum and classical theories and the microscopic limit in our paper was not very fair, because the classical ones were much more complicated. So in the quantum ones, we were assuming that the particles have only finitely many levels. But in order to explain what happens when you bring these kind of experiments to the macroscopic scale, you have to invoke classical models in which each of the classical particles is producing some signal that varies along a continuum. So in a sense, this is infinitely more complex than this other model. So this made us think, could it be that we're just not clever enough? That maybe there is some map between quantum and classical models in the macroscopic limit, which says that for any quantum model with finitely many levels, you get a classical model also with finitely many levels. But no, this is what we discovered using the techniques that we developed. So consider this experiment. It's a family of quantum optics experiments where you have some event that produces many copies of the maximally entangled state of two photons, for example. And then you put some polarizers, you can switch, decide which angle to put, and then you have a photocounter that measures the all this intensity of the beam. Okay, you want to explain the statistics that you get in quantum mechanics using a classical model. You can do it because of macroscopic locality. And let's make some assumptions now about this classical particle model. Well, we're going to allow this in this situation that Alice and Bob's particles have a different nature. So Alice could be receiving muons and Bob neutrons. It doesn't really matter. They can be of different nature, but the important thing is that the nature is not going to change because of the interaction of Alice or interaction of Bob. So it may be that this particle will have some levels. We don't know anything about these levels. We don't have any promise on these levels. But the levels do not depend on how Alice is interacting with this particle. It will just, the direction of Alice with the particle is going to change the distribution, the probability distribution among all these levels. Okay. Well, under these assumptions, you can prove that you can find distributions that you can generate with the setup that I said before, where you have only n settings at each site, which you cannot approximate with classical systems in which Alice's particles can have infinitely many levels and both particles can have of the order of the square root of n levels. Because you can make this n as large as you want, this implies that these kind of maps do not exist. If you want to understand a quantum, macroscopic quantum system, you have to invoke classical systems in which things form a continuum. You cannot stay at the discrete level. Okay, so I'm finishing now. Well, this is more or less what I said, right? I mean, if you start observing macroscopic data, you can get scale-independent information about the structure of the macroscopic system which created this data. And I think that the keywords are scale-independent. Before we started this, we couldn't believe that this was possible, right? But yes, it is. And I'm going to show a slide that now I feel a bit embarrassed, but you have to take into account that I prepared this talk in 2011, and I was young and impulsive. So I thought at the time that all these ideas, all these tools, would have found some application in some other fields like computer modeling or biology and sociology. And at some point, I had many conversations and many interviews with many doctors, neurologists, and biologists, right, in order to try to find an application, but everything was in vain. I remember even a conversation about of 5 hours speaking about blood with a hematologist. And it's horrible, and I don't recommend it, and it's really, really difficult. I realize it's really difficult to say something concrete in biology because you cannot simply replicate experiments, right? So you don't really have independent realizations. You cannot even estimate a probability distribution. Everything is really, really complicated, and I realize that, I don't know, theories live in a kind of a limbo, right? I mean, we sometimes we don't really go back to Earth and try to understand whether the things that we're talking about make actually some sense in the real world. Okay, I didn't find any application. The status is exactly the same. But I think, nonetheless, it was interesting to give this talk, so I want to thank Ravi for giving me this opportunity. Something about this thing about quantum mechanics that I told you. Thank you.
Can you go back to the last non-trivial or
okay.
Let's say,
this one?
Say non-trivial.
This one.
Just beyond the next one after.
This one?
Oh,
no.
Further. I mean, closer to the end.
This one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Why does the previous slide imply this?
Because it's the same experiment, right? And in principle, I could choose as many settings as I like.
I thought you put a bound on the number of levels of Bob. In this it says...
Yeah, how about...
In this it says Bob could have only at most square root of n. But in the next one, you allow an arbitrary number of...
Exactly. But I can make n as big, as large as I like. Because these are the settings. So these are just the angles in which I can measure these things. They can be as many as I like. So I cannot bound. I just cannot bound this.
Would you be, I'm just missing the point, would you be able to, in this case, if you gave Bob more levels, would you be able to approximate the distributions?
But you have to fix n, right? Why would you fix n?
Suppose we did fix n.
Okay.
Then would you be able to?
Yes. I'm not sure. Yes, you can. Yeah, indeed. You fix n and you increase the number of, even if you put finally many levels on Alice, right? The problem is that you cannot bound it from the dimension of the quantum system. That's the thing.
Oh. So in this thing you require to have the number of settings can be arbitrarily.
Yes.
The thing which this prevents is to match the distribution for an arbitrarily large number of settings.
Yes,
is that right?
Yes. For a finite number of settings, you can always do it. You can always work around this.
So would this have some, does this suggest an leaving aside a hematology experiment? Does it suggest a physics, an optics experiment, or something to test?
Yeah, you could conduct the experiments I described before with Gaussian states of light, right? And then try to falsify some of these models, right? Also, you could, I have many ideas, but I forgot most of them. You could apply to situations where you have variables which, in principle, are not independent. They form clusters or what? At the beginning, I was thinking that perhaps you could apply to cancer research, these kind of things. Because cancer cells tend to group into clusters, and because they group into clusters, then the variables that they have, the inner variables, and then they get correlated with each other. So as a whole, they work as a variable with many more outcomes. And then I thought that by analyzing the blood samples of some patient a long time, then I could get an estimation of how large these clusters are. And everything works theoretically, but in practice it doesn't work because you cannot repeat experiments.
So what would be the, in the cancer case, what would you be ruling out? What model of the tumor would you be ruling out?
No, you would, that's the other thing. They are not really good. Okay, I was assuming that they were really, really good models, mathematical models for how a cell behaves. But I talked to a mathematician who's also a specialist in cancer research, really interesting guy, and then he explained me that there are some models, but they are just toy models. Nobody really believes on them. So you cannot really use them. So yeah, there were really lots of trouble. There are some models for how a neuron works, right? Some of them are discrete, but the number of levels that they can take.
You have this bipartite situation.
No, but it can be multipartite.
Oh, do you have a multipartite? What are the parts?
The parts could So what you're measuring is that the presence of some substance in the blood, how it fluctuates a long time.
Yeah.
So the amount at one time and or the other is the different variables. You can have as many variables as you like if you wait enough. You have to repeat this many times in order to estimate the distribution.
Okay. But could you name a specific model that would be ruled out?
No. That's my problem.
I mean, maybe an unrealistic model.
Unrealistic models? Yeah, many. Yeah. No, where the paper everything works, right?
What would be an example of a model that you could rule out?
Okay, you could imagine that a cell it releases, I don't know, it releases an ion of calcium, right, during the experiment, or it releases zero, right? I mean, this could be 0-1. And in principle, if the cells do not group into clusters, they should be kind of independent, right? Whether of another cell, right? Another cell could do exactly the same, plus 2+ or 0, right? So it would be a dichotomic model. But now suppose that these cells, are cancers or whatever, they tend to group into clusters, right? So this cell is really close to this one and it's close to this one, right? So what happens is that these two distributions become correlated. So now, effectively, you're working, if you're like M cells, right? I mean, you're looking at a scenario where this mega cell can produce any number from zero to n ions of calcium.
I see.
Okay, so then, and it is different. It will give you completely different predictions as you make measurements along the time.
So what you're ruling out is that the cells behave independently.
Yes, exactly. So this will be, you will get actually a microscopic spin model to describe this kind of things. And with these ideas, you can rule out that, yeah, you can even put bounds on how large these clusters will be. You could put lower bounds.
Uh-huh. Well. Have you thought of any experiments for testing space-time discretization?
No. No. Well, no, I did, but I forgot about them. I guess they were not very good.
You're testing what? Discretization? Discretization of space-time? Because I thought you said that in your motivation somewhere.
It's true. I thought about this, but I came up with some model in one dimension where you could say things, but you have to wait for the order of the edge of the universe. So, you know, the moment that you start doing physics, it wasn't that good.
How would it, even in principle, how would you
suggest
for discrete?
Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
I don't remember, actually. No, sorry. I should have noted down these ideas.
One other question. I don't know enough about optics laboratories, but are Gaussian states a typical thing?
Yeah.
I mean, easy to produce?
They're really easy to produce. And actually, 10 years ago, everybody in quantum optics was working in Gaussian states, because they are so easy to produce, and also you can apply Gaussian operations, which are operations of bad Gaussian states into other Gaussian states. Well, a coherent state is a Gaussian state, for example.
Yes, but that's a Gaussian state of many.
Huh?
That's true.
Well, it's not squeezed, right? So it's uncorrelated.
So then the question is, would there be a realistic?
You can do the experiment, of course. You can generate a squeezed state of light, then you verify that it's a Gaussian distribution, and then if you prepare in a certain manner, you could rule out these moles. Yeah, of course you can do it.
So it's been done already?
No, I don't think so.
Do we want to do it? I mean,
I don't know. No, at some point I got very excited with these promising ideas about neurology and hematology and things like this, right? And I forgot completely about the initial motivation. Yeah, I don't know.
But a sort of a garden variety squeezed state would already be the kind of counterexample that you could actually verify experimentally.
The problem is that for what I understand, if you try to produce the squeezed state which are really highly squeezed, at some point you start losing Gaussianity.
Oh, you mean you fail to produce the squeezed? You don't produce the desired squeeze state, in other words.
Yeah, exactly. There's some limits to the squeezing that you can put.
With the level of squeezing that you would need, I mean, to rule out a dimension, the microscopic description, I mean, would you need to have something that's scaling like one of the squeezing that's like 1/d or something like this?
Yeah, around, yeah.
But one thing, I mean, but there's both statistics here. I don't see how much that's, I mean, if you use light,
yeah,
if you use a coherent state, then you can't neglect the Bose statistics of the lights, of the photons, right?
Ah, you mean because it's discrete or
No, I'm just thinking, how could the model possibly make sense? Because it doesn't include the Bose interaction or the Bose nature of the individual particles. I mean, the model you're ruling out is some independent.
Yes, okay, I see what you mean.
But by the fact that they're bosons, we already know that.
Yeah, it's true, yeah.
I mean, you'd only want to do an experiment like this if the models you were trying to rule out were plausible to begin with. Right.
But I think in this case it's plausible. I feel like, we could be squeezed, but it could be. I'm not assuming that they are photons. I don't know what they are. Oh, they could
but
be different.
I mean, isn't even the unsqueezed state is not a bunch of independent pairs. It's in a bunch of just a single beam of.
No, but I don't think.
State, it's not really a bunch of independents.
Yeah, no, I agree, but this is what I'm trying to. I mean, I know the theory. I know that the theory allows you really to create whatever is squeezing. So of course you cannot explain it with this microscopic dichotomic model, in the correlations.
So the last part of your talk, since it's about this quantum classical transition in some sense. I mean, couldn't this be useful also to understand how classical behavior emerges from quantum behavior?
Well, this is what my collaborator and I did in this old paper.
Yeah, so I don't know. Can you say a bit more about this?
Yeah, sure. So well, in this paper, we just made this observation that whenever you take a quantum system and do this kind of experiment, you always get something that has a classical explanation. So what you could do is to, well, we call this principle macroscopic locality. So even though the initial system was microscopically non-local, then macroscopically everything becomes local. And then you could go the other way around. You could say, okay, suppose I have some distribution. I don't know if it's quantum or not. It can be whatever. And then I impose that if I replicate, I impose this principle of macroscopic locality, so I have many copies of it, meaning dependent copies, I impose the whole distribution is local. So this imposes a very strong restriction on which is the set of initial microscopic distributions. And one of the things that you get, for example, is this famous Cdelson bound. So you have this inequality. So this Bell inequality that in classical systems is bounded by two. Supposedly these are variables which can take values plus or minus one, and these are the x's belong to Bob and the y's to Alice, or vice versa. And there's this classical bound of two, right? I mean, if you violate this bound, then you're outside classical physics, right? But the quantum bound is the difference to square root of two. So you can prove that any distribution, any microscopic distribution which violates this bound will not satisfy this property. If you try to bring it to a microscopic scale, you will have something non-local. So in the paper, we managed to characterize the set of all distributions which satisfy this macroscopic locality. And what you find is that this is like the set of all distributions which satisfy quantum mechanics, which are a set of quantum mechanical systems. You get a thing which is a bit bigger. Call it Q1. And well, in some places, these two things touch, right? Like, for example, here in the Cdelson bound, right? But in general, they are different. And actually, well, that was actually the initial motivation. I wanted to understand what happens in these experiments if you demand these kind of constraints. What kind of relations do you have? And the problem is that you can't really demand this. Otherwise, you don't recover. Well, if you demand that this thing the other model has a finite number of values, then you have to allow the classical model to signal.
Did you have a question?
Maybe. I'm not understanding. So you said to show that the answer to this is no, you needed an arbitrary number of settings?
Yes, yeah.
So it's kind of like you're inputting an infinite dimensional classical system, but what? The settings, the space of the settings,
But in the quantum case, you obtain all these settings from a finite dimensional description, right? Well, so you have to go to an infinite description to explain the classical case. Infinitely many parameters here, and here you only have finitely many.
So how many settings are there on the quantum side here?
It can be as many as you like. I didn't put a limit. Experiment is this one. This is one. You prepare many copies of the maximal entangled state and then do this. So the settings are given by the angles. In principle, you can choose whatever angles you like.
You said that the values in the classical case need to take a continuous interval. Is that actually important, or can you get by with?
No, it's enough to be discrete. You can use this thing here, right? I mean, you have infinitely many levels, right? As long as you can tune As long as you can tune the scale.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So thinking about this question about the macroscopic limit or macroscopic regime. Of course, there would be cases where it wouldn't be Gaussian, the correlations wouldn't be Gaussian, where the central limit theorem doesn't apply, so they wouldn't necessarily. So can you say anything about recovering those as well?
But in that case,
I guess that you could recover any, you called it macroscopic locality or something like that. But I understood that applied only to macroscopic Gaussian distributions, is that right?
It's true. Yeah, well, okay, we know that there exist macroscopic non-Gaussian distributions which are not local, right? Because otherwise you couldn't violate a Abelian equality in the lab. So I don't know what else one can say about this. But you can think of sort of a situation where you have a sort of macroscopic limit and where you recover, classical physics. I didn't think much about all those situations. I know there's a paper by Charles Bruckner that he considers, it's a similar scenario, but the resolution of these variables, the measurements here, are such that he cannot really detect fluctuations. He can only measure like average values. And then he finds that in systems of spins, he can find a classical evolution equation. This is the only thing related, I assume.
Is that all the questions that stack together?
Thank you.